do need to proceed to finish on time. If you could please take your seats. Thank you. It's my honor to introduce to you Rabbi Menachem Mordechai Huelig, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University's School of Talmudic Studies since 1973. He's a Sgan Rosh Kollel for Lahara since 1987, and he's one of the world's leading authorities on issues pertaining to the Aguna. Rabbi Huelig received a bachelor's degree in math in 1968 and a master's degree in Jewish history in 1971. That's what it says here. I should say it. Rabbi Huelig is a spiritual leader of the Rav of Young Israel of Riverdale. And really what he's doing is we have the opportunity to ask. It's an open forum for anyone who wants to ask any questions of halacha. And the floor is open. If anyone, everyone who wants to ask a question could go to the mic. And questions on any topic, I'm told, are... you're free to ask whatever you want, and I'm sure we'll be getting a good open response. Here you go. Pleasure to be here, and I'm happy to take any questions. Yes?
It's a bit of a loaded question, and it comes in a few parts. I'd like to hear the Rav's opinion on the concept of, if we, in the realm of tax evasion. And in encompassing that question, I'd like to cover, in other words, what degrees, like, in other words, non-reporting of income, even the occasional lunch where you have on a personal basis, do you write that off? If you have a phone or a fax at home, in other words, are there different degrees? And there are different situations, issues of Dina d'Malchus Dina, and what, or Shev Al Tassus, if you can encompass some of those areas.
That is a loaded question. But I will try to address it. In tax evasion, there are a number of very serious problems. According to some authorities, every penny, every last penny that you are not giving to the government in taxes is a serious violation and a Torah violation. This seems to be the opinion of the Rambam, for example. The Rambam's view is that an individual who owes money even to a non-Jew and does not pay that money is in violation of a Torah prohibition, and therefore it's a very, very serious matter. There are, as usual in halacha, conflicting opinions. Not everyone accepts the opinion of the Rambam. There are some who say, there are some who go to the extreme and say that even if someone steals from a non-Jew, it may not be a Torah prohibition. That opinion is, generally speaking, rejected. We generally assume that stealing from non-Jews is a Torah prohibition. That's almost universally accepted. However, there's an in-between position. Let's review again. According to one view, generally speaking rejected, even stealing from a non-Jew is not prohibited by Torah law. According to the Rambam's opinion, in the other extreme, not only is stealing from a non-Jew prohibited by Torah law, but even a failure to pay back a debt or to pay a debt to a non-Jew is also prohibited by Torah law. The in-between view, which is subscribed to by many, is that stealing from a non-Jew is a Torah prohibition, but failing to pay a debt to a non-Jew may not, in fact, be a Torah prohibition. Okay, that's introduction number one. Introduction number two, how do we view the quote-unquote non-Jewish governments of today? Some say non-Jewish governments today should be viewed as non-Jews, because basically it's a non-Jewish entity. There are those who disagree and say no. Whatever you read in the Talmud about non-Jewish governments, that's referring to a despot who put all the money into his pocket. And it didn't matter to the despot what was going on in his realm. It doesn't matter how much money is going into his pocket. Contrast this to a democracy, where there is a certain thing called a budget, and if one individual pays less, the government will come back and tax everybody even more. In which case, we cannot view the non-Jewish government as a non-Jewish entity, but rather a collective of many entities, including Jewish ones. So again, before we get to the topic, there are two introductions here. Number one is the three opinions concerning what is the Torah prohibition with respect to Jew versus non-Jew. Again, some in the extreme say it's even permissible by Torah law to steal from a non-Jew. That's rejected normatively. The Rambam in the other corner says that even failure to pay a debt to a non-Jew is a Torah prohibition. That is a valid opinion within halacha. And the in-between view, which states that taking from a non-Jew is a Torah prohibition, not paying a debt to a non-Jew may not be a Torah prohibition. And then the second factor is, how do we treat... the next issue is, how do we treat non-Jewish governments of today? Are they considered non-Jewish entities? Or perhaps we can no longer do that given the reality of the taxation system. That's the background. Now, having said all this, which leaves the situation a little bit murky, I'd like to begin my answer to your question.
So pervasive, I don't think you can walk in the streets of shopping neighborhoods and not do a cash transaction during the course of the business day. So, which is a normal understanding of business, how would the halakha
affect? So let's take a step backwards. I want to begin by saying that the unfortunate reality in many parts of North America is that there is a widespread misconception that doesn't matter what we do with respect to the non-Jewish governments, they're all no good, and we can do whatever we want. This is an outrage. It's an outrage. And in analyzing the behavior of people of our community, you begin to wonder, how did this outrage emerge? This doesn't seem to be consistent with our general manner of comportment. I believe it's an extension of yesteryear, extension of governments that were oppressive and anti-Semitic. One can only think back to the communists in Russia, which is, you know, in our memory, and those who perhaps are older may remember some of the pre-World War II governments which oppressed the Jews, were anti-Semitic towards the Jews. In those circumstances, one perhaps can take certain liberties because, you know, they're not treating you fairly. None of this applies to the governments of North America. I will talk as a citizen of the United States, the citizens of Canada. These are both Western democracies. These are both governments that are anchored in principles of righteousness, not without their flaws, but it doesn't matter. But these are governments which are not anti-Semitic. There's no state-sponsored anti-Semitism in these countries, thank God, and we have to be grateful for that. The leader of our generation in Pesach Halachos, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal. And he has a very famous responsum, which he decries these illicit activities. And he points out that we're privileged living what he called a malchus ha-chesed, which means literally a kingdom of kindness, which is exactly what the governments of North America are, the kingdoms of kindness that are tolerant and even supportive of the kind of diversity that we as practicing Jews and even general Jews can thrive in. And hence, we dare not pay back this kindness with illicit activity, which is more appropriate for dealing with the Tsarist Russia or the Communist Russia or the anti-Semitic Poles. That's a very important point that some people in our community haven't caught on yet, that the sea change that has transpired when we crossed the sea from Europe to America. That's my general point. Now, narrowing down a little bit, there are individuals who think that, you know, I can do what I want and I'll never get caught and, you know, it's okay. It's not okay. The most important reason that it's not okay is that you will get caught. And not everyone will get caught, but enough will get caught to create a sin which transcends the detail that we began discussing. And that's the sin of Chilul Hashem, the desecration of the name of God. And that's something which the Talmud teaches is no atonement in life. Even death doesn't atone for Chilul Hashem, because you're desecrating God's name. How could you do something and say, well, I won't get caught? Are you sure? I'm pretty sure. Positive? If it were Russian roulette, you know, there were that many bullets in the gun, would you take a chance and press the gun? You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that because you're afraid to get killed. Well, here too, you're afraid you're doing something which is so bad, Chilul Hashem, which is so bad, you dare not do anything of the sort. That's as far as what I would call wholesale violation of the law. Your question is a much more nuanced question. You're not discussing someone whose his own personal business involves tax evasion. That, we assume, is beyond the pale. Absolutely no excuse whatsoever. And I'm emphasizing again, no excuse in the world for that kind of a behavior. Forget about that. You're asking a different question. You go into a store, and you get an impression, if you give him a $100 bill to pay for some item, there will not be a full tax reportage. As if, perhaps if you pay with a credit card or with a check, there might be a greater chance of tax reportage. What is your responsibility? That's a totally different question. So that leads to a combination of these many factors. Number one, if you assume the opinion of the Rambam that every penny that's not reported to a non-Jewish entity is an absolute violation of theft, you have a serious problem on your hands. Because if you have this feeling that your payment in cash is leading to this Torah prohibition, you should be doing whatever you possibly can, again, whatever you possibly can, to avoid creating this situation. I'm told, again, I'm not in the world of business, I'm told that there are certain kinds of situations where it's well nigh impossible to avoid these kinds of things. In other words, there are certain businesses that just, you want to buy a particular product, you can only pay with cash. There's no credit card, there's no checks. Now, remember, we shouldn't go too far. Cash is legal tender. I'm serious. If a person refuses to take cash, that is an illegal act. At least in America, in the USA, it's illegal. It's illegal to refuse to take cash. I'm not sure how it is in Canada. The government declares that cash is legal tender. So if you just say, well, you know, I refuse to deal with cash, it's almost unconstitutional and to go against that basic point. And here's where my thinking is. Everyone should try, if possible, to observe the most strict version, which is that of the Rambam, that either the Rambam's position, that even not paying a debt to a non-Jew is a Torah prohibition, or the other alternative, that the governments of today, since they collect the taxes from Jews and non-Jews alike, cannot be viewed as non-Jewish entities. We should all attempt, to the best of our ability, to aim for that ideal. Nonetheless, it seems to me as follows. If you are the individual who is paying a storekeeper with cash, and this storekeeper will underreport. Right? Underreport. So let's put things in context. If he's underreporting massively, and can therefore be caught in the web which will lead to a Chilul Hashem, that would be a disaster. But it's hard to say that your $100 is the cause of that disaster. The much bigger fish that he's dealing with which is leading to that disaster. So I don't think you can really fault yourself for the cause of the Chilul Hashem in that kind of a situation. However, you may look yourself in the eye and say, how can I give him $100? After all, according to the opinion of the Rambam, he doesn't report the $10 tax and $100. That leads into a Torah prohibition, a formal prohibition of $10, which you are perhaps unwittingly or accidentally contributing to. That's a serious issue. However, there is another side of that issue, which is that since not everyone agrees with the Rambam, there were those, again, the extreme view that there's no prohibition even of stealing, but put that aside. But there's the in-between view, which does have many adherents in Halacha, that's simply reading the Gemara in the Masechet Baba Kama, that although one may not steal from a non-Jew by Torah law, but the failure to pay a non-Jew may not constitute a Torah prohibition, then you may say, even if I want to be more strict and follow either the Rambam's view or the view that treats the non-Jewish government as a partly Jewish entity, some kind of a partnership, nonetheless, I'm not in violation of the Torah prohibition of what we call lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, of placing a stumbling block in the path of someone who is figuratively blind, if that individual has some view that that individual is relying upon. So that may be a mitigating factor in your question of paying in cash. Someone asked a question before, when I say there's no Torah prohibition, is there a rabbinical prohibition? Well, as far as outright theft, even those who deny the Torah prohibition agree that there is a rabbinic prohibition. As far as not paying a debt, those who deny the Torah prohibition, who disagree with the Rambam, may even deny a rabbinical prohibition, except when it will lead to this Chilul Hashem. So this is therefore a very loaded and complex question. I try to give as thorough an answer as I can without taking up the whole time, which it can easily take up for this question and answer session. I'm ready to proceed to the next question with your permission.
Questions, if you could please go to the mic, please.
We should put the mic in the middle so it'll be easier for if it moves.
I guess it's related to this discussion and to your talk before. What about the instance where someone wants to make aliyah and they have a debt, but it's not to Jews?
A very good question. Someone wants to make aliyah and has a debt to a non-Jew. In my view, that aliyah should not be made. Should pay up his debt to the non-Jew, and then it should make aliyah.
But I've heard differing views.
Okay. I respect the rights of others to disagree with me. I hope they respect my right to disagree with them. Next question, please. Yeah. A few questions, okay, but meanwhile, very people are very reticent.
If anyone else has a question. So, Mike, and if you want to line up, we'll ask a few questions at a time, and then Rabbi Willig will answer them one after the other.
I want to ask you a specific question, but I'll leave you to figure out what you want to say. Professor Berger wrote this book on Lubavitch and Messianism, and are there any halachic issues in, let's say, davening with Lubavitch today?
I'm not sure which book you're referring to, but I do believe that that is a question which it's a little inappropriate for someone coming in for an hour to tackle. It's a very complex question. It depends upon the, in my view, the particular conduct of the individuals to whom you're referring. I would only say that if, this is an if statement, if there is an instance in which individuals ascribe divine powers to a human being, whether dead or alive, that this constitutes a very serious theological problem. If, however, there is no such manifestation, then the problem is of a totally different nature. So it's difficult to even begin to analyze the question without dividing it into many subsections. The issue of whether there can be a Mashiach who had certain messianic qualities in his lifetime and then died and then can come back as a Mashiach, cannot exist in framework of accepted Jewish thoughts, that is that's a loaded question too. I'm not sure if you wanted to ask that. But my personal view is that it cannot, and that's my reading of the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim. I'll just tell you one story about this, and then I'll go on to something else. I heard this from my Rebbe, from Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, that Rav Chaim of Brisk was once on a train, and there was a Christian missionary who was taunting a Jewish individual, and they were sitting on a train, and was telling him that, you should believe in Jesus. And they're going arguing back and forth. And the conversation turned to Rabbi Akiva, who believed in Bar Kokhba. I'm going to get back on this. It's a very large topic. Who believed in Bar Kokhba. And you see that that Jews can believe in a human being as being the Mashiach. And look, obviously Rabbi Akiva was wrong, so then you should now believe in Jesus as the Mashiach. And the guy is flustered, tongue-tied, has no to answer. So Reb Chaim over here turns to the fellow and says, "My dear friend, how do you know that Rabbi Akiva was wrong?" And my case rests with that. Okay. Okay, are there more questions?
if I'll take advantage of the moment now, just to follow up on the question, what about, going back to the taxes, what about inconsequential things which is a common practice, and I think that's what you're asking, common practice to avoid? For example, I'm in my office, I make a long distance call to my sister. Do I have to go to my do I have to go to the phone records and make sure I pay for that individually, or do you see that that's what's sort of common practice in the going into the variety store and they're taking your money and it's not necessarily with Nehi Ver, it's for a non-Jew? Are you do you have to take precautions that shouldn't happen? It happens practically every day.
The variety store takes your money. I'm not
and they take the cash and they put it in the side drawer. So you have to tell
Side draw.
Well,
well, look, okay. All right. I'm so glad that question was asked. One of the disastrous consequences of individuals who take license and liberty with respect to the reporting of taxes is that they incredibly jump to conclusions and say, well, if I don't have to be so careful with my relationship with the government of Canada or of the United States, hence, I don't have to be so careful with my relationship with a particular business entity, such as, you know, making telephone calls which I shouldn't be making, or in my relationship with insurance companies or telephone companies or utilities. Some of them, you know, they're so big, these guys, that you sort of view them as quasi-governmental agencies. That's absurd. I don't know enough about the stock market, but I think I know a little bit. These are corporations that are owned by individuals, and they have nothing to do with the government that's owned, if you will, by the entire people. Even if we accept the more, we'll call it the more lenient view, and consider the government of Canada or the United States as a, quote, non-Jewish entity, there's no way you can extend that to the telephone company or to a business that you happen to be involved in, because that is what we call a partnership owned by Jews and non-Jews. And even the most lenient view with respect to how you deal with non-Jews cannot condone any slight deviation from the absolute halacha because they're a Jewish owner. But on the other hand, there's always two hands, the corporation itself may allow you to make a personal phone call from your desk for a simple reason. For you to go to the, I'm not sure if you have cell phones here and where they work. You have to go to someone that doesn't work in the building. You have to go outside. You have to go to a payphone. It'll cost them more in time lost for you to go to a payphone cell phone and call someone on a personal basis than to just cost 10 cents you call from your desk. That is something which common practice plays a role, and not the total role, but a role, because people, the companies say, listen, it's not worth it for us for you to leave your desk when you have to make a phone call. Just do it. But that's nothing to do with the government issue.
One part of the question I was asking, I own my own business and I want to use the phone and for private use, but I'm not claiming that as a taxable benefit. Where if an auditor would come in, he would say, who cares? They're not after your $2 phone call. So in the common practice that the government doesn't seem to look carefully at those type of practices, but technically it's wrong. That's the question. And there's many, many instances like that.
These are difficult questions to answer. You have to first speak to an accountant to find out exactly what the law is, because we sometimes think we know what it is, we don't. If there is a, we'll call it in American language, a U.S. language, a loophole that the government has built into its system, there's nothing wrong with taking advantage of a loophole. If it's not a loophole, it's something which is technically speaking prohibited, but if you try to report it, they'll look at you like you're from, like you're wasting my time. It's not worth the time of the government to figure out how to collect that tax from you. They're going to lose money on it. So that's, again, it's something which is similar. But you have to be, it's impossible for me to go into all the nuances. There's just too many. Why don't you go to the mic, if you don't mind. The rabbi.
I'm the last person to cut off a discussion on business ethics. But if I can move it to another area, I want to talk on Shabbos, and actually also on non-Jews, and the problem. Let's say in your house, what exactly a non-Jew can do for you in terms of, it's very common, I'm sure in the States too, and I'm sure in Riverdale also, you have a live-in maid in terms of dishwashers and stuff like that, which she could really wash, you know, dishes by herself, but for her job, and how we would distinguish between you know, if she doesn't do it, her hours, let's say, end at 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and, you know, otherwise she'll do it on Monday morning, et cetera. You don't exactly tell her what to do. You know, the whole problem of the contractor, that whole issue of what they can do with the lights and et cetera.
Very good question. Well, again, that's another few-hour discussion, but we'll try to be brief.
We'll try to be brief.
There are a number of prohibitions involved with a non-Jew working for doing malacha for a Jew on Shabbos. One of them is if the Jew tells a non-Jew to do so with the words, that's called v'daber davar. Another one is what's called shlichus. What the non-Jew is doing for you is considered rabbinically as if you're doing it. And that applies even if you didn't say anything. As long as it's done on a regular basis, every single week, even if nothing was ever said, nonetheless it's considered to be he's doing it as your agent in effect. That's a very serious issue. So for example, if there's a non-Jewish person who comes every week on Friday night and turns off the lights and then turns back on the lights, and things of this nature, on a regular basis, that is prohibited because it's considered as if he is your agent, even though you never said a word. Because the repetition of this act so many times constitutes this clear agency, if you will. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Not even a question about that. That's not allowed. Now, as far as washing dishes, that's a totally different story. Washing dishes itself, as such, is not necessarily a prohibited act. Let's start with the washing dishes from Friday night for Shabbos. Let's start with that. So in my house, I wash the dishes. I wash. The other members of the family wash the dishes. And we manage. If we have no hot water, we use cold water. We have a little hot water. We find a way how to do it. Now clearly, if we never had a live-in, but if we did, that live-in would not be restrained as we are by turning on the hot water. That would put the hot water on all the way. That would make it much easier to wash the dishes. What's wrong with turning on hot water? What's wrong with turning on hot water? What's wrong with it? The hot water's there already. What did I do wrong? There's nothing wrong with turning on hot water, except new cold water will enter into the tank, quart for quart, take out a hot, and that's not allowed. What's wrong with what that called? Let me use the word sick ratio. That's the right word. You're doing A is having hot water come out. Nothing wrong with having hot water come out. If you shut off the cold water intake into the hot water tank, there's nothing wrong using the hot water that exists if you can get it out with the pressure and if you can find a way to do that. Nothing wrong. What's wrong is the secondary conclusion that there is the resultant coming in of cold water and hot water. That's called psik resha. Well, according to the Mishnah Berurah and others, there's no prohibition of telling a guy to do A even if it inevitably leads to B. If you did it yourself, you're in violation of psik resha. You tell a non-Jew to do it, there's no violation. Presumably the reason being, you didn't tell him to do B, you told him to do A. A is okay, B is an outgrowth. So therefore, in my view, one is permitted to tell a non-Jew, Miss or Mister, please turn on the hot water faucet, directly. Because it's only a psychration. So therefore, that's okay. What about using the dishwasher? So therefore, that's a different story. To tell the person to please activate the dishwashing machine, That's slow. So that's a no-no because that's already a prohibition. Okay. Now, you tell the person, please wash the dishes. Now, there are two ways to wash dishes. You can wash the dishes using the hot water, which is permissible. You know, he's permitted to tell it explicitly to do that. And you could also wash dishes using a dishwasher. This individual chooses, for reasons which we can understand, to use the dishwasher instead of using the hot water from the sink. This is technically speaking permissible. There is a potential what's called apsha milsa issue, which means it's making a lot of noise and it's not nice, it's not right, etc. So for this reason, I would encourage that the non-Jewish individual who's doing the dishes should do it at a time when no one is milling around. Now, how you do that, either she arrives early Saturday morning, stays late Friday night, or uses a timer and has the dishes be washed at 4 a.m. when presumably no one is around. This is only permissible for a non-Jewish person. A Jewish person may not use a dishwasher on a timer. As far as asking a non-Jewish person to do something in preparation for a weekday active, for weekday. In other words, to save time for during the week, that's what's called hachana. We assume that it's not allowed, although there's a disagreement. However, the case you described, where otherwise she would come on Monday morning to do the dishes, in all likelihood, what that means is, I'm not going to use these dishes until next Shabbos. These are my Shabbos dishes. So the fact that you would like the dishes to be cleaned earlier rather than later has nothing to do with saving time on Saturday night. Absolutely. It has nothing to do with that at all. It only has to do with making a house neat and clean. So it's a matter of making a house neat and clean. So then it's arguable that it could be done even on Shabbos. But I don't see why. I mean, if I had a non-Jew in my house on a Shabbos, even though I could technically justify it, I would have a different solution. Let the person fill the dishwasher. I'm in no rush. Fill the dishwasher. And then after I make Abdullah, I just press a button. And then it goes. If it's no rush, it's much better to do it that way. Okay. All right. So what should be done then is find a way to do it at the time when no one is around. You use those dishes. And then you don't have that problem. Okay. Try and do the best I can under these difficult conditions. Yes.
I'm asking this question because I find myself having the same discussion every Shabbos morning with a certain family member of mine, which is, can a girl brush her hair on Shabbos? And the reason I'm asking this is because I had asked this once a long time ago of a rav, and he said, if you use a brush that doesn't brush out the hair, it's soft, you don't do it vigorously, then it would be okay. But as a certain family member of mine points out, no matter how softly she brushes it and how gently, there's always one or two hairs that come out. And so she feels it's a psik resha. I say it's the lo nichale. And so she should brush her hair, and I want her to look nice on Shabbos. And she says, but no matter how softly you brush it, it comes out. So okay. What do you say?
Okay. I'm sorry to side with your family member, not with you. That is that if, in fact, it is a psik resha, even though it's lo nichale, it's still prohibited. This is a good question. Why? One has to look in the Rivosh, one of the early authorities. It's cited briefly by the Shaar HaTzion in the bottom of the Mishnah Berurah, I believe at the end of Simen Shin Gimel, very end, in the bottom of the one-line quote of the Rivosh, in which he says, this is worse than a psik resha lo nichale. Mind you, even psik resha lo nichale, the quantum of most authorities is prohibited. But the Rivosh was arguing with somebody polemically. He really gave him a very, very hard time. He said, even according to the Oruch that permits psik resha lo nichale, combing the hair is nonetheless prohibited for a whole series of reasons. It's worse than a plain psik resha. It's what I call in my language to the Talmidim, a super psik resha. There's no way out of it. And therefore, it's prohibited. However, having said that, it's only because you're describing to me that the brushing of the hair, in the case of the family member, inevitably, no matter how soft and how gentle, always pulls out hairs. However, if one could find some different device which would not have a psik resha feature, then it would be permissible.
Every frum girl I know brushes her hair on Shabbos. If this is the case, how can it be? And also, would looking nice on Shabbos for a girl play in any role in this at all?
I'll answer both of your questions. The frum girls who are brushing their hair on Shabbos, undoubtedly, in their case, it's not a psik resha. Not everyone's hair is the same. Undoubtedly, in their case, they are able to find a soft brush which does not pull out the hair on Shabbos. I'm sure if you'll ask them, that'll be the result. And secondly, as much as we are concerned about the appearance of individuals on Shabbos, nonetheless, this does not allow us to brush hair or comb hair if, in fact, it is a psik resha. Yes?
I'd like to change the subject, if I can. Regarding organ transplantation and halakha, I have difficulty understanding the compelling arguments about why not organ transplantation, particularly because, obviously pekuach nefesh is involved, and why that doesn't trump every reason for not doing organ transplantation.
Okay. Let me answer your question in a Jewish fashion with another question. Let's say there are two people, both are alive, we'll call one Reuven and one Shimon. But Shimon is dying, unfortunately. So we'll go to Reuven and say, don't put your hands. We'll cut out his heart and transplant it to Shimon. Would anyone allow that?
Okay, to make it an easier...
No. Just answer that question first.
I would think no one, because that's just murder.
Okay. So that's not allowed. So pikuach nefesh is important, but it doesn't quite trump everything.
Well, no, you don't want to pikuach
nefesh
somebody else's
pikuach. So you began to answer the question. If an organ transplant, an organ transplantation, which requires the removal of a beating heart, which is the only way that modern medicine, even to this day, can do it, unless some doctor has a new system that I don't know about since I was last in New York and I heard about it. The only way now to save a heart for transplantation is to take out a beating heart. That's it. And therefore, if one views the beating heart as a sign of a live individual, conceptually, it's like walking over to you and me with a stick up and taking out an organ. I'm told that in certain places in the Far East, they don't do it with hearts yet, they do it with kidneys. Literally. It's all about carjacking. There are kidney jackings. They go to a guy where they put a gun to his back and say, don't move, take out his kidney, and it's mind-boggling, but, you know, huh? So that we wouldn't allow. So we wouldn't allow it, for, certainly even more so, that person going to live with one kidney. Certainly we wouldn't allow it to be done with respect to someone to taking out one's heart. The whole idea of organ transplantation in respect to hearts and such organs is based on a new world definition. What is that? That someone whose heart is beating is considered to be dead. This is counterintuitive to the halacha. The halacha generally views anyone whose heart is beating as being alive. And if he's alive, one cannot easily justify the removal of that heart. You're using new terms that are not found in the Shulchan Aruch. In traditional svarim, the definition of death is when the heart stops to beat. And when the heart, as long as the heart is beating, the person is considered to be alive. Any desire to change that definition, the burden of proof is upon the one who wants to change it. There has been significant rabbinical disagreement on this point. There are some who accept what was just mentioned, a brain-dead definition. A careful perusal of recent medical literature will demonstrate to you that the idea of brain death being death is increasingly out of favor in the medical community for a whole variety of reasons. One of them is they say it's just empirically not true. It's not true. When the brain is supposedly dead, it's not dead. The hypothalamus is functioning, the body temperature is normal, etc. The second reason is the other way around. It's very restrictive. Therefore, the new twist on it is, hey, come on, brain is not really death. We're taking out the organ to save the next life. So therefore, as long as the person has a persistent vegetative state, even though it's not brain death, we can take out the heart the same way. You see, the slippery slope is not merely a fear, it's a reality in the medical community. So therefore, to justify these things is very, very complicated. However, there are certain cases in which organs can be harvested without compromising human life. Yes, that exists in certain organs, not as vital as heart transplants at the present time. And if that can be done, one could speak very favorably of it. But even in that kind of a case, you have to be careful, because in some instances, they prep you. The individual is very sick, and they want to wait until the heart stops beating, and they want to do a transplant immediately. They'll prep you with certain things while your heart is still beating, which will hasten your death. So they're hastening death in order to have the heart stop at a certain, you know, now. And then we can harvest the organ when you're in better shape than otherwise. This itself is a very serious issue, and I've discussed it with transplant doctors. There was an orthodox transplant doctor who lives not far from me, and he told me, look, if you've got the brain dead definition, that's fine. If you don't, you're really on very thin ice.
Okay, if we can just sort of sharpen the question, and if we say, according to, say, halakha, that the person is, in fact, dead in every way, brain dead as well as heart stopped beating. Certainly right. You can harvest kidneys and liver and pancreas. You're right about the heart. It was more oxygen sensitive, but the other organs certainly can go with the person being dead by everyone's definition. There still seems to be a tremendous reluctance for Jews to give organs, although they're first on the list to want to receive organs in the event that they are in dire need.
I don't think that's unique to Jews. I think that most people want organs if they need them and are not running to give away their organs. And that's probably true of most of the people on the planet. The proof is, if of the 6 billion, of the 6 billion people on the planet, if everybody but the Jews would be donating their organs, we'd have no issue with today. So to say that, you know, it's a Jewish issue.
No, but in proportion, Jews are in fact the worst.
I'm trying to explain to you.
Yeah.
If all the people who were not Jewish would have no problem giving away their organs after they're dead, according to all views, you and I wouldn't be discussing this right now. The answer is, even people who do not have halachic imperatives are hesitant for a whole variety of reasons to involve themselves or their family members in organ donation. So it's not fair to just say, well, it's only the halachic Jews that have this reticence. Nonetheless, it is correct to say that, in my view, it's correct to say that donating organs from someone who is dead to save lives is something which is halachically permissible, perhaps even mandated. Nonetheless, at the present time, it is a bit difficult to order such an organ donation without fear that the kinds of practices that we discussed earlier, such as branded definitions or profusions and other kinds of medical practices which may hasten death, will take place. In the case that we can separate one out from the other, then I think that your question is a very valid one and should be considered very seriously by rabbinic authorities and by the people of Israel and the people of the world. Yes.
I have a question. It's borderline halakhic. The Rav had mentioned that he was a student of Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha. And recently I heard a lecture about how Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal was a very stout Zionist. So when I was listening to the lecture, the whole time it kept coming into my mind why, when the State of Israel was established, had the Rav Zichrono Livracha not gone to Israel?
That's a very good question. One I'm not qualified to answer. I think that if one asked members of the Rav Soloveitchik's family, there are, thank God, many of them with us today, one might get a more of an insider's answer to that question. Theoretically, though, just to leave Rav Soloveitchik out of the picture, there were many individuals who were, we'll use the word Zionist in its most positive term, who loved Eretz Yisrael, who for a whole variety of reasons did not emigrate to Eretz Yisrael before the state was established, after the state was established. Certainly for me, living in New York City, take a pot shot at someone else who didn't go to Israel in 1948, that would be ridiculous. So I can't say anything negative about that. There are individuals who feel, and leaving out any particular persona, that their contribution to the community here in North America could not necessarily be replicated in Israel, and therefore perhaps they should be staying here and serving the people better here as opposed to living in Israel where they would not be able to serve the people so well. Just to give an example, but this is really just speculation.
I'd like to ask a question. What is your view on donor eggs for IVF? In a nutshell.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there are a number of issues with respect to donor eggs. One is, who is the halachic mother? Is the donor mother, genetic mother, the halachic mother, or is the birth mother? Is that your question?
No.
Okay. Okay.
That's the issue that if you were allowing donor eggs, let's say to explore if the donor is, let's say, a non-Jewish mother.
All right.
So you somewhat avoid some of those issues, but we still, the question is, if it's done, is it prescribed?
Okay. Okay. My view is that we try everything else. For a variety of reasons, both halachic and beyond halachic. But if the only way that this woman can carry a baby and her husband can have a biological child is through a donor egg, in my view, it's permissible through the IVF. And my view is, although I'm not convinced this, I'm not sure about, is that I'm leaning to the position that the genetic mother is the mother. That's a major dispute among the rabbis on both sides of the issue. Some say it's genetic, some say it's the birth mother. My personal inclination is that it's the genetic mother, but I wouldn't follow it to the exclusion of the other view if it came to any practical case. In other words, I would require a gerus in both directions. If a non-Jewish egg is used and the birth mother was Jewish, I would require a conversion. And the other way around, I would also require a conversion. There are different opinions on that matter. My personal view is no. I think that it's better to, again, a host of other reasons, to use a Jewish donor egg, but to take the proper precautions to see to it that there not be any incestual relationships down the road, things of this nature. But it does add a level of complexity. I agree.
Can I just follow up one more question?
Sure. You're the boss. You're the chairman.
No, but you were, when you respond to brain death, you said there's no definition of brain death in the halacha. There's also no definition of a genetic mother through donation of eggs, which wasn't recognized in halacha also. So how do you come to the genetic mother?
That's a very good question. Yeah, okay. One has to study the Gemara in Masechta Yevamos in a couple of places in that. Tzadi Ches, in that. Ayin Ches. To see whether maybe we can somehow glean halachic conclusions from genetic moment of conception that has carried greater weight. And again, no one has a text in front of you. It's a bit beyond the purview of this shir. But I'm not saying it's just based on touchy-feely. Okay. I'm saying it based upon a Talmudic text. Yeah.
I just want to know how you would relate to what the halakhic definition of creating a fire would be on Shabbos. That would be in relation to something like fluorescent lights, which is heating up a gas, which is basically what a fire is. How that would be in relation to fire, heating up even a non-gaseous element, like heating up a light, like an incandescent bulb, and then relating that to halakhos neros.
Okay. My opinion is, and this goes back into rabbinic discourse of years ago, an incandescent bulb is a violation of mavir because it's a filament, which is really basically a fire. A fluorescent bulb is not. It's just a sodium light is not. These are gases. These are not actual fires. However, with respect to hadlakas neros, your second part of your question, to my mind, there's no need for a quote-unquote fire. And therefore, again, in my opinion, one can discharge the obligation of hadlakas neros with incandescent, with sodium lights, with fluorescent lights, any kind of light. But the custom, of course, is to use candles or oil, which should be done. If it cannot be done, then the other kinds of light of lights can be used, in my opinion, even with a brocha of the Hatz of Neshul Shabbos.
Is that part of
No. That's Bar Moresh is a different story. That's a different story. The only chance of Bar Moresh is if you're using a clear incandescent bulb. Not frosted, as most of ours are, not fluorescent, not sodium. And even there, according to the Mishnah Berurah, it cannot be used because of the glass. But that's a matter of dispute.
Why is that a fire?
It is a fire because it's a filament which is like a wick, and it's a fire which is like a fire. The reason why it can't be used as a bar mesh according to the Mishnah Berurah is because the glass is intervening. That's why you can't, even if it would be a regular fire, a kerosene lamp, you've got to take out off the glass before making bar mesh. That's a very good question. Very good question. In my view, that yes, if asking a non-Jew to put on a fluorescent light on Shabbos, the rabbi is asking the question because I just said that a fluorescent light is not aish, not a fire, and therefore it's, let's assume, a rabbinical prohibition. And the rabbi is aware, as I'm sure many of you are, of a concept called shvus de shvus b'mokol mitzvah. You may tell a non-Jew to do something which, even for you yourself, would be a rabbinical prohibition if it's needed for a mitzvah. I believe the answer to that question is as follows. Shvus to shvus to makom mitzvah only applies to a case in which there's no way to do it differently. So therefore, if you have an emergency situation, your Shabbos talk didn't work, or some issue came up, a medical issue or something of the like, which you didn't anticipate, it's permissible to tell the non-Jew to put on the fluorescent light because of Shavuos to Shavuos, B'Makom Mitzvah. To do it as a matter of course, however, is not allowed. Because even B'Makom Mitzvah, we assume, can only be done in an exceptional circumstance, not as a matter of course.
What does the halakha say about inviting someone over for Shabbos knowing that they'll drive home, and whether it's a friend or your parents or family?
Okay, that's a very good question. Inviting someone on Shabbos when they're going to drive home. It's accepted that to ask someone to drive to your house on Shabbos is a serious halakhic problem. It really shouldn't be done unless there are extraordinary circumstances, which we call Eis Lasas Lashem Eferu Tarasech. You break the rules because it's such a dire need. By and large, it should not be done. However, if someone is invited for Friday night and asked to come early and given an opportunity to stay over, and this person chooses to drive home anyway, that's somewhat different. Because, you know, you have a clear conscience, you gave them a place to stay, they decided to pick up and leave. The problem is, if you know in advance 100% they're going to pick up and leave, then it's a little bit more difficult to justify. Because, you know, you may be fooling yourself, like, yeah, I have a bedroom, I made up the beds, it's pillows and blankets, beautiful. But you know 100% the person's not staying. So who are you fooling? So even in that kind of case, I would try to avoid such a circumstance. Again, unless this is kind of an eighth lassos, Lashem Eferi Torah Secha mandate. I would concede, however, that in the case of the Friday night invitation, when they're coming before Shabbos, that the level of the eighth lassos mandate can be a bit lower than it would have to be to have someone come on Shabbos proper. Family, again, is not essentially different. It just maybe have the greater Eis Lasos Lashem Eferi Torah Secha concept. But no rabbi, in my opinion, can just go into a community and say, well, that case is Eis Lasos or it's not. That requires an on-site rabbi who knows the community, who knows the people. And by definition, it's an exception. And to promulgate exceptions for someone who's from far away, I think, is inappropriate. Yes?
There's a problem, as you know, it was discussed in other lectures today, with shidduchim. And my question is as follows. If you have a young woman or an older woman who's into looking for a husband, the only time really when they have the opportunity to meet people very often is going to shul on Shabbos. This is the time when maybe they can't brush their hair, they can't put on makeup, they're really at a disadvantage. So could you take the concept of shvus to shvus and lokom mitzvah to give them a heter to make themselves look more attractive on Shabbos and Yom Tov when they are in a public setting?
That's a very good question. Let me begin by discussing the issue of the makeup that you made reference to. I'm not an expert in that field, for sure not. But I'm told that they have these tricks. There's now a lipstick that lasts 24 hours. I disclaim it before I began, but that's what I'm told. And the makeup, somehow you put it on a certain way. People, when they go to sleep at night, they I don't know, don't we use a pillow? I don't know these tricks, but as a first measure, one should attempt these devices to maximize the proper appearance on Shabbos morning. It's difficult to allow something which is really prohibited on the basis of it leading to the greater possibility of finding a shidduch. What I would recommend, maybe the rabbis can take heed of what I want to say, is let's make the social gatherings on Friday night, especially now in the winter time. It's very early. It'd be an appropriate time. Just got out, you know, of the shower with the makeup, with the lipstick, with the hairdo, with everything. Now is an appropriate time to establish a proper setting for boys and girls to meet. And my time is up.
Any more questions? Do we allow more questions?
The influence of Kabbalistic things on halacha. And how should we heed them? For instance, not looking at the Levuna or a Keshes or these things. How important are these halachic things? Or are these more Kabbalah things? When you're taking a look at the Levuna and your parents from the old country, they're saying, "Vus kikmen of the Levuna," you know, But are these halachic issues, are these more kabbalistic things? And if they are more kabbalistic things, should we still keep them as such?
I'll answer you. Whatever is a halacha must be heeded. That's clear. That which is Kabbalah, which is not found in halachic sources, the Mogen Avraham says, if the Kabbalah does not contradict the halacha, then one should try to adhere to what the Kabbalah says. However, I emphasize the word try. By definition, Kabbalah cannot be mandatory because it's supposed to be a secret. And one cannot demand that everyone know all these secrets. There are many secrets that you and I don't know. And so therefore, just to summarize, if it's a halachic matter, even though it sounds Kabbalistic in its overtones to you, it has to be observed. There are exceptions, that there are some things which the Gemara says are dangerous, and later sources say that nature has changed, they're no longer dangerous, and therefore one need not be so careful. However, something which is not halachic is only Kabbalistic. The Mogen Avraham says we should try to adhere to them, but one can only say it's a voluntary act. One cannot, in my mind, make anything which is Kabbalistic in nature without any halachic source to be considered mandatory, since even the knowledge of it is not mandatory, how much more so the observance of it. I want to thank you very much for your good questions.
Thank Rabbi Willig for really answering questions from a very wide range of questions. And that's Rabbi Willig. Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you very much.